Blog Talk Radio.
There are 1,199 minutes of productivity remaining before the weekend.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think,
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without your being aware of it.
Oh, man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Another U.S. soldier died in Afghanistan over the weekend. The Associated Press says it's the 2,000th member of the U.S. military to die in the longest war in U.S. history. The attack happened at a checkpoint, but reports conflict about the details. The number of civilians killed in the 11-year war is not known, but most estimates say at least 20,000 have died. In October 2001, the U.S. led a coalition force to Afghanistan to oust the Taliban and rout al-Qaeda. The U.S. still has almost 70,000 service members in the country, along with their coalition colleagues and contractors. In Iraq, another series of bombs killed at least 26 people yesterday, bringing the total dead there in September to 365. The attacks struck Shiite targets, and according to Hakim al-Zamili, a Shia member of parliament, the situation in Iraq is still unstable and shows that security forces are still unqualified to deal with the terrorists. California Governor Jerry Brown was busy signing laws this weekend, including a measure that bans so-called treatment for gay kids that tries to make them straight. He also signed a bill that gives juvenile offenders sentenced to life without parole another chance at freedom, and he gave the okay to driver's licenses for undocumented youth. But he wielded the veto pen as well, and immigrant rights activists say two of their top priorities were blocked. KPFA's Christopher Martinez explains.
Immigrant rights activists collected petitions, held prayer vigils, and even sent flowers to California Governor Jerry Brown, urging him to sign a pair of measures to limit deportations and grant basic workers' rights to housekeepers and other domestic workers. But late Sunday, Brown vetoed both measures. The bills were a top priority for the California Immigrant Policy Center. Reshma Shamasunder, the center's director, says she sees the vetoes as Brown turning his back on immigrant communities.
This was Governor Brown's opportunity to be a champion, for California to be a leader. Instead, he's failed us. Instead, you know, thousands of families will continue to be separated, immigrants deported, and domestic workers won't have access to the types of labor protections that, you know, most other workers enjoyed.
The Domestic Workers Bill of Rights would have given California's 200,000 domestic workers, most of them immigrant women, the right to overtime pay and meal and rest breaks. It's similar to a measure recently enacted in New York State. The other bill, called the Trust Act, would have limited local police participation in the federal Secure Communities program that has led to the deportation of almost 80,000 undocumented Californians. Activists say they'll continue the struggle in the legislature and in the courts. Christopher Martinez, FSRN, Berkeley.
Security forces patrol a Bangladesh village today after weekend rioters burned down at least 13 Buddhist temples and monasteries, along with dozens of houses. The violence started after a picture of a burnt Quran appeared on Facebook. Prabhakar Manituwari reports.
Police have arrested more than 150 people and are looking for 1,500 more in connection with the violence and arson. On Saturday, Muslims, already angry over an anti-Islam film made in the United States, attacked a Buddhist-majority village in Cox Bazar. They ransacked homes and torched Buddhist monasteries and temples. The violence later spread to the neighboring Chittagong district and continued through the night until security forces reached the area early Sunday. Buddhists staged a silent protest in the capital Dhaka on Sunday afternoon. A heavy contingent of security forces is now patrolling and public gatherings have been banned in the Buddhist-dominated areas. Senior officials say the man who posted the image that started the violence has been detained and is in protective custody. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN.
Hundreds of protesters marched in Chicago yesterday calling for more jobs for blacks. The rally was called by prominent black Chicago businessman, 87-year-old Ed Gardner, who stopped work at the same job site last week after he drove by and saw no black workers. A few marchers spoke to Chicago's CBS 2 News.
We're concerned about black people working, not necessarily minorities. Minorities got their jobs, the black people don't.
This may be groundbreaking because you have a retired senator, you have retired judges, you have the president of Chicago State University, you have black millionaires.
It's a shame that an 87-year-old man had to stop his car and come out here to protest us.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel says the city has strict hiring rules and they must be enforced. The company said there were no black union cement layers available for hire. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, our October 1st, Monday news night. I have some good stuff for you. Really, got some good stuff, I think. Coming up, Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg's Building Bridges, their community and labor report, of WBAI-FM, New York City. On the Chicago teacher strike, lessons learned from the Chicago teacher strike. Then we'll go to the complete program of Free Speech Radio News. And then tonight, a special, the final straw, that's what they call it. Produced out of Asheville, North Carolina. It is a show that comes out weekly, I believe, Asheville FM. In the event, the host will be interviewing Gail Stevens, who is the mother to one of the Cleveland Four, a group of activists and anarchists who are arrested, charged, for attempting to blow up a bridge. You'll learn all about that and the trial and the plea bargains that have been going on. It's all in the second hour. You know, I'd like to bring up some stuff that I saw, some local news. Well, not really local. I want to congratulate the local PBS affiliates for broadcasting Bill Moyer's weekend program. If you missed it, it's still available. It's online at Bill Moyer's. I think it's Moyer's and Company now. I think that's what they call it now. Certainly worth your time. This particular episode last weekend dealt with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and really was great. It pointed out the age. Let's see, this particular episode dealt with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and as well as other influences that have taken place through ALEC, A-L-E-C, and pointed out how the Wichita Koch brothers, the Wichita-based Koch industry, has targeted contributors to Walker, and money in the states are they've learned. Now, this is something that's important, I thought, that I picked up out of it. I've suspected for, well, last two or three years, on going through the campaign records of our state legislators and even my local ones, and you go through the donations, who gives them money. It's, you know, $500 here, $250 there, $100 here, all of them from Cokes. And it's not just from 1 year, and it's not just to the governor or to the big campaign like Brownback. It's systematically distributed. That's why I took to calling it Coke seed money, because what they do is they take their influences and they throw the money around, and they've got so much of it, they can do that. 100 here, 250 there, 500 there, 2,500 there. And then another dirty little secret that I think that my theory is, and many investigative journalists are uncovering some of it, but I think if I had plenty of time and I had a budget, I would go around and note who are the Koch associates in Wichita. Because when I know for a fact when they hold these secretive little private parties, or they call them, they're like, you know, it's like a teach-in on a billionaire scale, every 6 months at their semi-annual get-togethers, the Koch boys take a lot of Wichita people with them. Wichita people show up. Who are those Wichita people? Well, I know some of their names. And if you track that, those names, cross-reference with the campaign donations received by our state legislators and by Governor Brownback or any of our, name your congressman, you know, they're all Republicans, you'll see the influence of not just the Koch brothers or Koch Industries, Charles Koch here in Kansas, but the neighbors. Yeah, and they steer the money towards, and they do it systematically over and over in the campaigns. And you begin to realize the power of the one percenters here in Kansas over not just the governor, Brownback, or the congressional federal delegation, but even down on the grassroots of our state legislators. Now, I haven't got a scheme chart. I don't have all the numbers, but I tell you, over the years, I've really went through the campaign donor list of my local legislators and people who I found out through the process were members of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Really on to something there. Now, local was Senator Tom Holland, who's been on our show. He's ran for governor against Brownback, really outgunned because Brownback would keep his mouth shut, would not debate public, restricted debates to one comedy circus down there in the Hutchinson State Fair. That's how Brownback wins. That's how Pat Roberts wins. They don't debate in public TV. They don't have the League of Women Voters or some independent person. I don't consider, really, here in Kansas, it'd be very difficult to find a journalist gutsy enough to get up and moderate a debate without sending previewed questions to the candidates. I don't even think that should be done. I really think that the journalists here in state have a big problem with access to power, and they don't want you to know about that. They don't want you to know that they can't, if they ask the wrong questions, say in a public debate on television, say on channel, on our PBS affiliates here in the state of Kansas, aired statewide conveniently on, so anybody can see the debates, and not just one, maybe two or three, like for governor, state attorney general. I firmly believe that they can't ask the hard questions because they'll lose their access. So what I'm trying to tell you is that we need someone, maybe I think the League of Women Voters, that's who used to do it. And, I think that's what you should have, someone who doesn't have a vested interest in advertising revenues or commercial broadcast journalism, something like that. Somebody like that should be moderating it, and they should be the debates, public debates, financed not by advertising revenues, but by the listeners and viewers of our public radio and public broadcasting services here, what few remain here in Kansas. It could be done on radio. It's even cheaper that way, you know? In any event, there should be more debates, and that's how the Republicans, that's how the hardcore radicals, who are not radical, they're not Republicans, radical extremists, conservatives, have taken over the state, if you ask me. Plus, the careful financing, the seeding, year in, year out, of damn near every politician in the state. So I was listening to Scott, Tom Holland, got off subject there, sorry. I was listening to Tom Holland's, it was excerpted on Kansas Public Radio, and he had it right. Tom's got it right, he needs to be more stringent. All of the Kansas Democrats need to be more stringent. But he was pointing out what's coming on the horizon here very quickly. This extreme austerity program that's been imposed upon the people, while giving massive tax breaks to 200,000 of the state's elite, 200,000 business people. I heard that on KPR, they call them the elite, Kansas elite. I suppose we're dealing with a state of 3 million people. Hard to believe there's that many people living here. 3 million people, and you think 200,000 are getting, they're not even going to be paying any income taxes. And they're not the bottom. No, they're the business people. So I think I heard that on KPI. I thought, you get sick about 200,000. I guess that could be the 1%. Yeah, who cares? The 10%. They ain't paying no taxes. Then I heard IKEA, I-K-E-A. I didn't even know what that was. I had to ask my more educated wife what it was. Well, it's a Swedish furniture company. They're opening up a big outlet, and I noticed on the television when they were stopping TV and running a crawl on the bottom of the TV. IKEA is coming. IKEA is coming. I think it's Lenexa or somewhere up there, right across the Missouri border on our side of Kansas. And from the diagram, it looks like they're going to tear down some perfectly decent commercial property and rebuild. So what is going on with these people? Who cares? Oh man, Swedish furniture. And she says she travels more than I do off the 10 acres every day. She pointed out that there's quite a few rich people down around the Sprint headquarters. She said it looks like Bahrain. That's what she quoted. That's her quote. She said it looked like a little Bahrain coming up out of the cornfields. I'm still choking up on that one. Those people can afford IKEA, high-class, high-priced Swedish furniture. So, well, what other was? Oh, Dave Lindorf. I got to move on because we're going to run out of time. Dave Lindorf at This Can't Be Happening had a very interesting email today. He's starting to drive, joining others who are trying to have Russia Today TV. They've got a station here in the United States, of course. Well, I see RTV on our PBS affiliates. And a lot of my guests who've come on, Lindorf, Ray McGovern, Danny, the News Dissector Schechter, they've all been on my show on Radio Free Kansas, on your show. And I see him on RT. Well, Lindorf's got a great idea. He thinks that there should be presidential debates on television that's coming up this Wednesday, the big debate between the two big parties. He thinks the third and fourth party should be put on there. Third and fourth party should be put on RT. That would be great. Well, there's an article at the top of the This Can't Be Happening News Collective website by Dave Lindorf, and it deals with that. I urge you to go there. You'll go through my reading list, but I really need to get us back on schedule here. There's an article, a really interesting article in Harper's Monthly. I got it. I didn't get the guy's name down, but it's the cover story. I think it's just like Why Vote. And I did not know, did you know, listener, that there's no mention in the Constitution about popular vote. The original Constitution had very little. They left it up to the states to carry on voting. It wasn't until the Civil Rights Movement in Section 5 where they, the federal government actually came in, I don't know, lack of better terms, interceded into state elections and stopped discrimination of voters within individual states. I did not know that. Yeah, interesting. I'll deal with that in the future. We've got all week. We'll be on every night. Bringing you the best that I can of the programming I can find. Anyhow, on to Ken Nash, Mimi Rosenberg's Building Bridges, their community and labor report. Then Free Speech Radio News, and then a very interesting interview, courtesy the Final Straw out of Asheville, North Carolina.
This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The Chicago Teachers Union, CTU, has a tentative agreement. Some have proclaimed the strike as the biggest and most inspiring union victory since the 1997 UPS Teamster strike. While it clearly demonstrates the resilience of unions and the viability of the traditional strike tactic, it also raises the limitations of what even the best-led unions can accomplish through collective bargaining alone today.
What are the lessons of the CTU strike for the New York City's public school personnel and its students, and for teachers, unions, and public workers across the country facing challenges to their very existence? We're joined by Kimberly Boesky, Chicago Teachers Union rank-and-file activist and a CTU House delegate and a member of CORE, the Council of Rank and File Educators, and Brian Jones, former New York City public elementary school teacher, now pursuing a doctorate in urban education, co-narrator of the film The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman, and contributor to the book Education and Capitalism, Struggles for Learning and Liberation. Well, congratulations. That's the first thing.
Double congratulations for me also.
But we want to find out what actually are some of the specific details that you think are productive and should result in an upvote of the contract, Kimberly.
Thank you for having me on, first of all. I really think that because this agreement was crafted by the rank and file members of the CTU, it should be taken seriously by its members and then by the community and by the board itself. We tried to win an awful lot of job protections and change the contract so that it will not only help protect workers, but it protects when students are in trouble, the worker can speak out. So, for example, one of our articles has attacked the idea of just being able to be fired for someone not liking you or for you not fitting the requirements of a checklist or of what is called local criteria, which means that the principal can basically pick a few things that he or she wants to focus on. And if you're someone that's a gadfly or the principal really doesn't care for you, those local criteria can be very arbitrary and change, resulting in a bad evaluation and your subsequent firing. So we've got stronger language in there. Now employees can only be disciplined for just cause. And the Board of Education has to provide our union with documents if there is a grievance filed, and also no more arbitrary disciplining suspensions. There must be progressive discipline used so that the employee has a fair shot to remediate herself or himself if something's wrong. We think that that's a huge accomplishment, especially for labor relations, and something very needed for teachers and educational personnel. So that's a really huge win. Other things that we won, can you believe that our clinicians get locked cabinets? Now they get locked cabinets. They get a bathroom break that's guaranteed. They get paper clips. Those things are silly, maybe, to some people, but to others, it's a real big deal. The fact is that we don't have that many clinicians for almost 440,000 students. We're woefully under the recommended amount. So we have anywhere between 300 and 325 nurses in our system of all these children. So we actually won some things. We won a full-time school counselor for every school. That in a system that doesn't use its clinicians very effectively. I mean, there have been years where our agreements have covered part-time or half-time staff or even 0.2 positions so that a clinician, a nurse, a counselor would have to visit several schools. That's an ineffective use of labor, and it doesn't help the children. Our children are very distressed. Some schools have the resources, and others don't, including human resources. So we think that this contract gives us a win in those areas. There are other areas that we can discuss, like I think that we've eaten back a little bit on teacher evaluation. Teacher evaluation talks had been going on since October with a team of people from the CTU. I was on that team. And then a team from the Board of Education that would then talk to the executive committee of the Board of Education, some of the bigwigs. And Illinois law only allows Chicago teachers, when talking about teacher evaluation, to consent, to advise. But the final decisions about teacher evaluation rested with the board. And so since the power was with the board, we were constantly arguing, trying to push them towards initiatives that weren't punitive for teachers, but at the same time could help tell us something about our children. And the board pushed back by pushing value-added measuring, which is a calculation that nobody quite understands, but it, in short, places value or places some sort of worth on a person's position and how much experience the person has. We could never get the algorithm from Chicago Public Schools on that, and it's very unfair to judge teachers or anyone by someone else's score or by some of the other things that go into a person having a score, like if they're hungry or what, you know, resources they've had or if they live in a poverty-stricken neighborhood. So we push back on those, and we think that we got in this contract a better position from which to now negotiate, because part of our contract says that we're going to have ongoing negotiations about teacher evaluation and tweak the system. So, for example, Illinois law, the PERA law, the Performance Evaluation Review Act of 2010, said that Chicago or districts that had 500,000 or more children would implement 300 schools in the first year. And the Board of Education in October wanted to implement them right away, all of these changes, including the test scores.
Kimberly, yes? We're going to go on with some of the other gains later on in the program, but I wanted to bring Brian in at this point also to talk, because this strike and the victories here not only impact on Chicago, but resonate with workers and teachers throughout the nation. So, Brian, what do you see from the New York perspective and perhaps a national perspective as the significance of this pushback by the Chicago teachers?
It's tremendously significant. I could listen to Kimberly talk about that all night, but thanks for having me. I just want to issue one quick correction, which is that technically I'm still a teacher. I'm only on a temporary leave of absence.
Better yet.
Yeah. But I do want to say that I think the Chicago Teachers Union strike, in addition to the material gains that Kimberly just registered for us and was ticking off, there's a tremendous moral victory in the mere fact of raising the enormous social question hanging over education, which is, why is it that people like Rahm Emanuel, classic members of the 1%, refuse to give our children the same kind of education they insist on for their own children. They have tried to get out of answering that question by hanging everything about the performance of a school on the teachers. And then they expose themselves in certain ways. The CTU made much hay of the conditions of the school in which Rahm Emanuel sends his own children. We could make the same argument about the school where Bloomberg sent his daughters. You know, they have three of everything, three libraries, three swimming pools, three science labs. And we have plenty of schools here with no science labs, with no libraries. Rahm Emanuel just had a commercial celebrating the new contract from his perspective about why it was going to make schools better and why he was right all along. And ironically, in his ad, he has kids, in the background over his narration doing art, except 40% of CPS schools have no full-time art teacher. He has kids in very small class sizes working with a teacher, except Chicago schools have some of the largest class sizes in the country. So fundamental questions of who gets what, of why we have what the CTU rightly called apartheid schooling in Chicago, were raised. And I think now the gauntlet is thrown down to those of us who've been fighting to defend and improve public education to make that same kind of case about our own schools here. Why do we have these mushrooming class sizes? And while people like Bloomberg send their kids to elite private schools with tiny class sizes, why do they think that small class sizes are so good for their children, yet not important for ours? And we think it's fundamentally a question of resources, of fairness, and the whole thing of hanging everything on the performance, the value added, so to speak, of the teacher is really about scapegoating teachers for the social crisis, about making teachers a kind of social scapegoat where everyone can direct their anger as a kind of misdirection so that nobody sees that we're dealing with austerity schools that have made year after year of budget cuts, oftentimes many budget cuts within the school year.
I've been aching to ask both you, Kimberly, and Brian. I went to a discussion at the Schomburg Center in Harlem and came out of there most dismayed. The audience was overwhelmingly African-American, and there was Stephen Carter, an attorney who has written a number of mystery books, and the latest being a novel on what would happen if Lincoln had been impeached, essentially. In any event, he's a Yale law professor, and there was Pat Battle, an anchor in New York, an African-American woman, started somehow the discussion by saying, or led into one part of the discussion by suggesting that her child was extremely bright, and as a result of being bright in a neighborhood public school, he was thus bullied because it's uncool to be bright in a neighborhood school. And so for his very bodily protection, she had to wrest him away from the terrors of the public school system and put him in a private school. From there, Stephen Carter talked about how he, as a Yale law professor, had a project where he was raising money in New Haven to wrest children away from their beleaguered communities, which were inherently Black and Latino communities, generally poorer economically, and which had nothing else to offer other than poverty and the indicia of poverty in neighborhoods, and again, put them in the private school. And this was the answer, and I was just, it got a good deal of applause, and I was just in such pain and such horror at what almost seemed to be a discussion of the talented 10th, and that the only way of saving a child and educating a child was to take them out of community. And what this meant for the denigration of the public schools was complete and total. I am just interested, because all of this goes to, for both of you really, the issue of public education. And I would like to know whether it's within the context of the CTU strike, which was a strike for personnel and a strike for students and better public school education, and Brian, yourself, what do we learn from this, or what are we supposed to be educating the broader public on who has such inherent contempt for public education?
And Kimberly, before you answer that also, do the parents in Chicago have this contempt also?
Well, I'd like to hear what Brian Jones has to say, then
sure.
I'll come up behind him.
Well, look, it's a mixed picture because, of course, African American communities across the country have been historically underserved, maligned by public schools often. And in the absence of a vigorous struggle that puts those demands, the needs of groups that have been specifically oppressed by this system, in the absence of a vigorous mass struggle to change those circumstances, I understand why parents want to strike out on their own and hit the lottery and do whatever they can do. I mean, I get that, and I don't begrudge any individual parent that effort. Of course, I understand that. I think that I've also seen the other thing. I saw that, you know, of course, the schools that are always targeted for closure are schools predominantly lower income, black and Latino families are sending their kids. And there was a vigorous struggle, a whole series of vigorous struggles last year to stop those closures. One of the most brilliant community-wide struggles where you couldn't see that contempt. In fact, you'd see something quite the opposite, community pride in their neighborhood public school, was the struggle to save Wadley in Harlem. And that was a struggle that was successful. Now, Hollywood isn't going to make a movie about that struggle. Those were public school parents standing with the union against the privatizers. So that's probably not going to get, you know, Hollywood funding. But it happened. It's real. It's a part of what's going on out there. And I think that in Chicago, I imagine, although I'm sure Kimberly knows better, that because of the way the CTU explicitly made a case about racial injustice, and specifically before the strike, fought with parents to try to save community libraries, to try to stop school closures, the parents are taking a different attitude and have an idea that instead of just escaping, there might be some hope of changing the school. And as long as the union and community activists and people are speaking out in favor of that project and then lending their bodies in a real and material way to that effort in a vigorous way, then, you know, it seems to me like people can get inspired by that possibility, not just escape.
Kimberly.
I think that the Chicago Teachers Union and the Caucus of Rank and File Educators specifically, we have waged a battle against school closures since probably 2008. And when Renaissance 2010 came in, which was a program by ex-Mayor Daley to close some of the schools that he felt were underperforming and replace them with these charters, it kind of got the movement really going. You saw a lot of community activists join with the CTU and CORE in trying to struggle against this. Last year, we waged that struggle, and the Chicago Board of Ed decided that it would close or turn around, as they call it, 17 schools. So we did not win that effort. There's this idea that if something is public, it can't possibly be as good as if it were elitist or private. So charter schools in Chicago carry an air of exclusivity, so that if you go there, charter schools are sold as being the option for parents and students if you want smaller class sizes. In fact, a statement was made by someone of a charter school organization that they were the answer to collective bargaining or against collective bargaining, so that the students were freed from the constraints that the teachers' unions would put on collective bargaining. And that's simply not so. The idea of that talented 10th deserving or meriting some sort of special treatment leaves a whole lot of people out in the dust. That's students and teachers. So we've tried to bring in this context of neoliberalism and the economy kind of pushing this argument out that charter schools are going to eventually be public schools and replace a traditional public school. So that's been part of our fight, and we're doing that now as well as in November. The Board of Ed will probably make a list of anywhere between 80 and 100, 120 school closings or schools slated for closure. So I get everyone's concern, and it really does bother all of us.
Kimberly, if you could go a little bit more into the ties of the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, and community groups, I think it would be helpful to understand what's been going on there.
The organizing that happened that brought you all together.
You know, we've had some amazing rank-and-file organizers, and we've been organizing not just delegates, not just people from the executive board, but the Chicago Teachers Union has an organizing department that's been doing a lot of outreach to to teachers in the pulpit, where we take training and we join up with churches, or we ask temples to allow us 5 minutes to speak in their bima about education issues or critical public school issues. So we've reached out to those communities, the religious communities. We've also done a lot of one-on-one talking, leafleting at L stops, flyering neighborhoods, with the intention not of just leaving a flyer and letting it passively sit, but getting to someone, talking to someone about issues. Because oftentimes the public doesn't really know. They only know from their own experience, which may be 20 years old, or, you know, way back when the system was slightly executed in a different way. There have been other groups that have gotten with us, a Southside group of rather well-off parents who like their public schools and don't want others to suffer any kind of bad fate. The 19th Ward parents, they've done amazing work of placarding and flyering and being on corners throughout for months throughout this year. There's Parents for Teachers, which is on the north side, that invites everyone, and they've been at every rally. They've had their own rallies. They've had their own walks, protests. And so the CTU has a lot of outreach in the community. And it's not just about teachers' concerns. It centers around the economics. It centers around the students. And it centers around the community and keeping communities solvent in a time of austerity. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps a lot. And Brian, I'm interested in how you pick up from this, or where a group like MORE, which is a coalition of groupings within the public schools, teachers in New York, have come together, and what they can learn from or employ, and what you think the issues are similarly that are impacting and will create major issues for our public school teachers and children?
Well, we have, very similar to Chicago, we have a neoliberal program of privatization, school closure, you know, bringing in high-stakes standardized tests, an incredible battery of very expensive tests, a testing regime. They're developing music tests and art tests and testing kids at an earlier age. I mean, it's completely similar to what's happening in Chicago.
John Coltrane wouldn't have done well with those music tests.
Exactly.
I love it, you know, music and art tests, yeah.
I mean, right, make kids hate music at an early age. I mean, it's
definitely
ridiculous. So there's a new caucus, as you mentioned. It began as a coalition, and now it's its own organization. I mean, individuals can join, and it's a union caucus within the UFT called the Movement of Rank and File Educators. So it's MORE directly. I mean, we're not trying to make any secret of the fact that we're modeling ourselves on CORE in Chicago. Our slogan is that our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. And we're trying to take the lesson from Chicago that we have to put a premium on speaking with the same voice as the parents and the students in the school. So we're trying to take up issues like the testing regime, questions of the curriculum, questions of racial and economic injustice in which schools are getting which treatment, which closure, which punishments, which schools are getting rewards. Also, even deeper issues that have to do with the institutional racism of the criminal justice system and the way it's now seeping into school and messing up the education process by giving kids summonses for minor infractions and criminalizing youth inside the school. So there's all these kinds of issues that cry out to be taken up, and we think our union will be better if it is set up to do that. And that's what we're trying to do, is change the UFT in a way that will allow us to press forward the kinds of struggles that we're going to need to defend our schools and to improve them, to make them the kind of schools that we all want them to be.
We also have a Chicago Teacher Solidarity Group campaign, and that was a group of people from various communities in Chicago who saw what was going on, wanted to make their own thing, wanted to help the teachers. And when we say teachers, we mean all of the people who are represented by the CTU. And so they made their own thing. They went out in the community and canvassed. They made shirts. They had forums. And also, in addition to the outreach, we had people reaching back. So we had support from all over this nation and all over the planet.
And do you think that part of what also drew the parents and students into support for the CTU, since certainly in New York there have been many historical rifts which have been based on racial issues, among other things, were some of the issues that were raised by the CTU around the plant facilities?
Absolutely. I mean, we have those very same problems, questions of air conditioning, questions of overcrowding. Especially now, the places where we've been dealing with charter school co-locations, often public school children, even elementary school children, have been pushed into boiler rooms, into closets, conducting class in situations that are not safe or appropriate for class. Now there's just been a new thing out that there's chemicals in the schools that activists have been warning about for years, not in all schools, but in some schools, that are at higher levels than, you know, we were told by the DOE, and so we're having to press forward questions around that. There's definitely questions of inequality and injustice in facilities, repair, infrastructure that have to be addressed.
And, Brian, is there a way to contact More New York?
Yeah, morecaucusnyc.org, M-O-R-E, caucusnyc.org. And just sign up there on the mailing list, and you'll get all the information.
And, Kimberly, we're going to give you the last word. Michelle Rhee was all over NPR, all over in response, and it really was a backlash against the success of the CTU. What do we say to the Michelle Rhees? What's the final thing that we should understand about what was affirmative and positive in the CTU taking command of the situation?
I think that one of the major things that came out of this is that it doesn't matter if you call yourself an education reformer. Education reform happens, true education reform, from the rank and file, from the people who are in the community, from the people who are in the streets, and from the people who work every day to see that children are taken care of, that they're given opportunity to learn, and that those people would take it upon themselves to walk out of work, to speak for themselves and make the point that outsiders can't keep using money to change education to a for-profit venture, that we're not going to let them do that to us, and that there's unity through strength. So money doesn't beat the true unity of rank and file and of the community.
Indeed, and we need to have both of you back and have more discussion on this. Too many important issues that we weren't even able to touch. But Brian Jones, thank you for all the work that you do. And
thank you.
Kimberly Bosky, yay, go CTU. We'll keep a close eye on it. We'll learn a lot of lessons from it. And we'll have broader discussions about what are some of the limits and what do we need to do to back up collective bargaining for our teachers.
But a real victory, something we haven't had in a long time. Congratulations again.
To both
of
you.
Thank you, and keep up the fight.
La luta continua, right. Indeed. Thank you both, Kim Lee Bosky and Brian Jones.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 1st, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court weighs whether corporations operating in the U.S. can be liable for human rights violations committed abroad. Labor advocates from the U.S. and Mexico press the Mexican government to protect guest workers at Walmart suppliers. In Russia, supporters of the band Pussy Riot rally in a case that has brought focus on restrictions on social expression in the country. And we'll hear from a journalist in Tehran who faces sentencing in court.
Our job is not to run away or to flee the pressure. Our job is to remain there, find a way to report correctly.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Another U.S. soldier died in Afghanistan over the weekend. The Associated Press says it's the 2,000th member of the U.S. military to die in the longest war in U.S. history. The attack happened at a checkpoint, but reports conflict about the details. The number of civilians killed in the 11-year war is not known, but most estimates say at least 20,000 have died. In October 2001, the U.S. led a coalition force to Afghanistan to oust the Taliban and rout al-Qaeda. The U.S. still has almost 70,000 service members in the country, along with their coalition colleagues and contractors. In Iraq, another series of bombs killed at least 26 people yesterday, bringing the total dead there in September to 365. The attacks struck Shiite targets, and according to Hakim al-Zamili, a Shia member of parliament, the situation in Iraq is still unstable and shows that security forces are still unqualified to deal with the terrorists. California Governor Jerry Brown was busy signing laws this weekend, including a measure that bans so-called treatment for gay kids that tries to make them straight. He also signed a bill that gives juvenile offenders sentenced to life without parole another chance at freedom, and he gave the okay to driver's licenses for undocumented youth. But he wielded the veto pen as well, and immigrant rights activists say two of their top priorities were blocked. KPFA's Christopher Martinez explains.
Immigrant rights activists collected petitions, held prayer vigils, and even sent flowers to California Governor Jerry Brown, urging him to sign a pair of measures to limit deportations and grant basic workers' rights to housekeepers and other domestic workers. But late Sunday, Brown vetoed both measures. The bills were a top priority for the California Immigrant Policy Center. Reshma Shamasunder, the center's director, says she sees the vetoes as Brown turning his back on immigrant communities.
This was Governor Brown's opportunity to be a champion, for California to be a leader. Instead, he's failed us. Instead, you know, thousands of families will continue to be separated, immigrants deported, and domestic workers won't have access to the types of labor protections that, most other workers enjoyed.
The Domestic Workers Bill of Rights would have given California's 200,000 domestic workers, most of them immigrant women, the right to overtime pay and meal and rest breaks. It's similar to a measure recently enacted in New York State. The other bill, called the Trust Act, would have limited local police participation in the federal Secure Communities program that has led to the deportation of almost 80,000 undocumented Californians. Activists say they'll continue the struggle in the legislature and in the courts. Christopher Martinez, FSRN, Berkeley.
Security forces patrol a Bangladesh village today after weekend rioters burned down at least 13 Buddhist temples and monasteries, along with dozens of houses. The violence started after a picture of a burnt Quran appeared on Facebook. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari reports.
Police have arrested more than 150 people and are looking for 1,500 more in connection with the violence and arson. On Saturday, Muslims, already angry over an anti-Islam film made in the United States, attacked a Buddhist-majority village in Cox Bazar. They ransacked homes and torched Buddhist monasteries and temples. The violence later spread to the neighboring Chittagong district and continued through the night until security forces reached the area early Sunday. Buddhists staged a silent protest in the capital Dhaka on Sunday afternoon. A heavy contingent of security forces is now patrolling and public gatherings have been banned in the Buddhist-dominated areas. Senior officials say the man who posted the image that started the violence has been detained and is in protective custody. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN.
Hundreds of protesters marched in Chicago yesterday calling for more jobs for blacks. The rally was called by prominent black Chicago businessman, 87-year-old Ed Gardner, who stopped work at the same job site last week after he drove by and saw no black workers. A few marchers spoke to Chicago's CBS 2 News.
We're concerned about black people working, not necessarily minorities. Minorities got their jobs, the black people don't.
This may be groundbreaking because you have a retired senator, you have retired judges, you have the president of Chicago State University, you have black millionaires.
It's a shame that an 87-year-old man had to stop his car and come out here to protest this.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel says the city has strict hiring rules and they must be enforced. The company said there were no black union cement layers available for hire. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments today to answer a basic question: should corporations operating in the U.S. be liable for human rights violations committed overseas? The outcome of Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum could determine whether other corporations around the world can be held accountable under a 200-year-old law called the Alien Tort Statute. FSRN's Alice Olstein was in the courtroom this morning and files this report.
The namesake of the Supreme Court's first case this term is Esther Kiobel, the widow of a Nigerian activist targeted for demonstrating against Royal Dutch Petroleum, also known as Shell.
My husband, he was the breadwinner of the family. And since Shell and Abacha government killed him, oh my goodness, I've lost more than 5 members of my immediate family. Life's so horrible.
Kiobel's husband Barinem was executed by the Sani Abacha military dictatorship along with Ken Saro Wiwa and 7 others in 1995. The surviving Ogoni activists and their families have been trying for more than a decade to hold Shell accountable for aiding and abetting the Nigerian military's violent crackdown on residents who protested oil spills and environmental exploitation in the Niger Delta. Yet throughout Monday's arguments, lawyers for Shell and the Justice Department and several Supreme Court justices warned that allowing the lawsuit against Shell to go forward would put several U.S. corporations and individuals at risk.
What if people try to haul the president into a Dutch court for bombing of Libya?
That's Shell Oil attorney Kathleen Sullivan speaking outside the court after the hearing. She said a ruling against Shell would bring conflict with foreign governments because the U.S. would be guilty of projecting its domestic laws abroad.
This case has nothing to do with the United States. The events took place in Nigeria. The defendants are English and Dutch companies. The plaintiffs are all Nigerian citizens and were located in Nigeria at the time, so there's no conduct in this country.
During the arguments, several justices questioned why the plaintiffs didn't file the lawsuit in the Netherlands or the UK, where Shell Oil is based, or in Nigeria. The plaintiff's lawyer, Paul Hoffman, argued that the U.S. was their adopted home, and the crimes against them violate universally accepted norms the U.S. has the obligation to enforce. One of the plaintiffs, Tony Adigma, told FSRN the U.S. should also hear the case because it claims to support the right to protest.
I came into this country, I saw people who are demonstrating on the streets of this country. There is nobody, no soldier, nobody arrested them. No army, no police arrested these people to torture them. But where I come from, you don't have the freedom to express yourself.
A member of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, Adigma was arrested and interrogated by the military regime after he organized several marches and protests against Shell in Nigeria.
If you look at my teeth, the damn one is broken because of the torture I had. I still have scars in my back here, but that's not what I'm here for. It is wrong to torture your fellow human being.
The Supreme Court first heard the Kiobel case back in February. Arguments then focused mainly on whether corporations can be sued under the Alien Tort Statute or only individuals. The justices then argued the case to be re-argued, broadening the question to whether any case against a foreign entity for harming foreign individuals can be heard in a U.S. court. Rick Kurtz with Earth Rights International, who filed a brief supporting Kiobel, said the justices should preserve the Alien Tort Statute's international reach. He called it a vital tool for protecting environmental activists like the Ogoni plaintiffs.
I hope they understand that the arguments made by Shell just aren't persuasive, and that, of course, you know, if you commit a crime that's a violation everywhere in the world, you should be held liable where you can be found.
If the court sides with Shell, it could mean less accountability for multinational corporations, especially those in conflict zones and countries with autocratic regimes. Several companies who themselves have been accused of abuses abroad filed briefs supporting Shell, including Coca-Cola, KBR, Chevron, and BP. But if the justices agree that the plaintiffs have jurisdiction, they would then have to wrestle with the question of corporate liability. The court could also follow the advice of the Solicitor General, who argue that cases against foreign individuals and corporations can be brought on a case-by-case basis. Donald Verrilli said the court should dismiss the Kiobel case, but consult with the State Department in future cases to make sure they properly balance international human rights concerns with U.S. foreign policy interests. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The results of Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum could have major implications for other multinational corporations accused of complicity in human rights violations and for the victims who have been seeking justice. One of those cases centers on ExxonMobil, the world's largest private oil company, and accounts of a handful of villagers in the Indonesian province of Aceh. Emily Johnson has more from the rice fields of Aceh.
The fence that surrounds the ExxonMobil facility in Aceh is about 10 feet tall and topped with barbed wire. On one side is a vast industrial complex. On the other is a tranquil expanse of rice fields, a common sight here among the agrarian villages outside of Lhok Samawe, Aceh's second largest city. A water pipeline runs the length of the fence. Teenagers are using it as a bench as they watch a pickup soccer game on a makeshift field across from an empty airstrip. There's a dirt road that connects to four main clusters of buildings and liquefied natural gas fields that make up ExxonMobil's Arun operation. The road is busy, but these days it's humming with local people on motorcycles rather than the military vehicles of years past. Up until 2005, a separatist conflict ravaged this region for decades. Now, the road's poor condition makes for a bumpy ride. I'm driving past the gas fields with Ibrahim, a local man who volunteers as a coordinator for a victims group. He points out various landmarks. The military post, where he says his friend was tortured. The warehouse, where he says human bones were found.
In the time, there is a children's playing around and digging something. Maybe they want to find something, and then they found a skeleton.
Ibrahim says scenes like this were commonplace during the conflict in Aceh, which came to a climax between 1999 and 2005. In these years, the Indonesian military waged a brutal campaign against the separatist Free Aceh movement, known as GAN. Aceh's civilians suffered the worst. Houses were burned, women were raped, and young men were tortured or executed for real or imagined connections to GAN. During the same period, Mobil Oil, which merged with Exxon in 1999, was extracting natural gas from the Arun field. The company had been working in the area since the 70s. Not far from the gas field, we meet a man sitting on a bamboo porch outside an old home. He rolls up his pant leg to show a nasty scar.
So it was come from here, and then it the bullet passed through this way.
This man is known as John Doe 8 in a civil action he and three other alleged victims filed against ExxonMobil in 2007. The complaint describes an unprovoked attack that left him unable to work. It says a group of Indonesian soldiers working as security for ExxonMobil shot him in the knee and left him in a ditch. He says the trauma of that day still haunts him.
Sometimes it's just flash in my memory. Can I survive? Because every day during the time, many soldiers come, and then there's a flash in his head. Is there going to shoot me anymore? Memories keep coming.
He pulls on a clove cigarette as he tells his story, just one of many similar accounts shared in villages throughout Aceh. He says the years around his 2004 attack were a dangerous time for any young man in the village. He wears false teeth, a souvenir of another run-in with soldiers he says were working for ExxonMobil.
If we say hi, they will say, "What are you looking for? What are you asking me?" And then they get angry, and sometimes they slap people and then kick people. And then when we keep silent, they will say, "You're very proud of yourself, don't you?" And then kick them.
He's not the only John Doe to seek justice in a case against ExxonMobil. In 2001, 11 other plaintiffs filed a related suit. Both cases say ExxonMobil is responsible for the alleged actions of its agents. ExxonMobil spokesperson Doug Eglinton recently told the Dallas Morning News that all the claims were baseless and that ExxonMobil condemns human rights violations in any form. Eglinton added that the company has a long history of improving the quality of life for the people of Aceh with added jobs, health services, and other community investments. Eglinton would not comment on the specifics of the case. But last year, a federal appeals court ordered Exxon to stand trial on whether the company should have known about potential abuses and taken more precautions against them. The U.S. Supreme Court is addressing this issue of accountability in Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Shell. The Nigerian plaintiffs say the Alien Tort Claims Act gives them the right to sue entities like Shell for aiding and abetting atrocities like torture and murder. Shell says the act doesn't apply, that only individuals and not corporations can be held liable for human rights violations. Human rights lawyer Terry Collingsworth is following this case closely.
I think that it would be a very, very large public disaster for the Supreme Court to, on the one hand, say corporations have all the rights and all the benefits of a citizen of the United States, but only corporations get this special immunity from human rights violations.
It's Collingsworth who co-represents John Doe 8 in the 2007 case, a simple tort suit. And it was his firm that also sued ExxonMobil in federal court on the other suit, which used the Alien Tort Statute on behalf of 11 Achenese villagers and their families. That's the case waiting on the Supreme Court. A ruling in favor of the Kiobel plaintiffs could clear the way for ExxonMobil to stand trial as early as next year. A ruling for Shell would likely mean none of the plaintiffs will have the chance to see their cases through. Emily Johnson, FSRN, Aceh, Indonesia.
This report was produced with the support of the media NGO Project Word, with reporting and production assistance from Mia Lobel, Hannah Rapley, Lisa Riordan-Seville, and Laird Townsend. For additional reporting on this story, visit www.projectword.org/Aceh, and that's spelled A-C-E-H. Workers' rights advocates and labor leaders from the U.S. are in Mexico to call on the government to step up efforts to prevent forced labor in Walmart's U.S. supply chain. In June, Mexican guest workers exposed poor conditions at a Walmart seafood supplier in Louisiana. Workers said they were forced to work 24-hour shifts and were threatened with beatings. In response, Walmart suspended ties to the supplier pending an internal investigation. But the National Guest Worker Alliance says it has preliminary evidence of labor violations at 12 other Walmart suppliers that rely heavily on guest workers, many of whom are from Mexico. The facilities are located in states across the U.S., including Mississippi, Georgia, Virginia, Texas, and California. For more, we're joined by Valeria Scorza, Deputy Director of the Project of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, a civil society organization in Mexico. She joins us from Mexico City. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
So who have you met with so far?
So today we had a meeting with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here in Mexico City and requesting several points to the Mexican government. The first request was that the Mexican government reveal all its suppliers in North America that hire workers from Mexico. The second was requesting the U.S. Department of Labor do a special investigation into labor conditions for Mexican nationals on Walmart USA supply chain. We also requested the Mexican government to request the Department of State to perform an inquiry into the health and safety of Mexican nationals of the Walmart USA supply. And lastly, we requested that the foreign ministry could also have a close collaboration with the Mexican Ministry of Labor and the Mexican State Department in order to really pursue an investigation and coordination of what are the conditions of workers leaving Mexico and going to work abroad under the guest worker program.
We're talking about Walmart, a company that is global but based in the U.S., and the suppliers such as the CJ Food supplier in Louisiana that started this latest investigation. Explain why the focus on Mexico and why the Mexican government for these facilities that are in the U.S.
Well, because in this supply chain, what we have found and the NGA, the National Guest Worker Alliance, had found in their reports is that most of the guest workers are Mexicans. So most of their labor force is coming from Mexico. So we are requesting the Mexican government to have a protection to their co-nationals and to have the obligation to protect Mexicans abroad. So that's why we're requesting all these issues.
And those are Mexican citizens, not Mexican-Americans.
No, they're Mexican citizens.
And also one of those who joined this coalition is the National Organization for Women. Talk about the number of workers who are women and the obstacles that women face in this.
Most of the guest workers are women, and specifically they affect women issues regarding discrimination, for example, and other issues. So we see that the Walmart model has specifically affect specifically to women the type of modeling of business that they do. So for us, it was really important also to highlight what is the effect of this type of forced labor towards women.
Valeria Scorza is the deputy director of the Project of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. She joined us from Mexico City. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Free speech radio news is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues are investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters. The bureau chief in Tehran for the news agency Reuters is facing a court sentence this week over so-called propaganda-related offenses for a headline posted earlier this year. According to the AP, Parisa Hafezi, who is an Iranian citizen, was convicted Sunday by a special media court in Iran. At issue is a headline for a video Reuters posted in February that initially described a group of women in martial arts training as, quote, assassins. After the story, the Iranian government suspended the Reuters bureau in Tehran, and most of the staff left the country, but Hafezi was not allowed to leave, according to the AP. In October 2011, FSRN sat down with Hafezi in Los Angeles when she was visiting to receive a Courage in Journalism Award from the International Women's Media Foundation. She began by answering why she stayed in Iran following the 2009 protests, even after she and her staff came under increasing pressure.
Because this is my job. Our job is not to run away or to flee the pressure. Our job is to remain there, find a way to report correctly. That's what I believe and I have always believed in. So that's why I chose to stay. And I prefer to be there and to experience that pressure but to report correctly.
In early 2010, during a time when reform leaders called for anti-government protests to restart, Hafezi was abducted, detained, and faced interrogation. She described what she sees as the role of an independent media in Iran.
Our job is to report impartially. Our job is to understand the facts and reflect it and convey that message to the world without being afraid of pressures that we get. This is our job, and we are doing that. Me and many of my colleagues in Iran who chose to stay in Iran.
That's Parisa Hafezi, Reuters bureau chief for Tehran, speaking to FSRN October 2011. On Sunday, Hafezi was convicted in a media court in Iran. The Committee to Protect Journalists lists Iran as one of the top censored countries for media in the world. As of December 2011, 42 journalists were held in custody, the highest documented by the organization in the world. In Russia, a scheduled appeal hearing for three members of the feminist punk band Pussy Riot was postponed today after one of the defendants refused the representation of her lawyers. The move was unexpected, and the reasons for the refusal are unclear. Out in the streets, supporters gathered for a global day of action in support of the band members, who were sentenced in August to 2 years in jail. The Pussy Riot case is leading to legal efforts to further restrict social freedoms in Russia in an effort some call dangerous. FSRN's Ekaterina Danilova reports.
Dozens of activists gathered in St. Petersburg to call for the release of the three band members from jail.
They also called for all political prisoners to be let free and for an end to legal measures restricting social freedoms. Pavel is a member of the anarcho-communist group Autonomous Movement.
We came here today to say no to all this tyranny of the police that is happening in our country, to say no to all these false charges, huge amounts of which are brought in our country, all the false evidence of policemen and judges who are bribed.
Pussy Riot's imprisonment for performing an anti-Putin song in a Moscow cathedral in February has spurred sympathetic political actions against the Orthodox Church. For example, a feminist group cut down a cross outside a church in Kyiv. This in turn has sparked legislation criminalizing criticism of the church, which was just introduced in the parliament. If passed, the law would create a penalty of up to 3 years in prison for insulting believers' feelings. Ольга Курносова is an opposition leader who opposes the measure.
It's absolutely clear that the law appeared mainly in connection with Pussy Riot, but it confirms one more time that they are in jail because of an unjust sentence.
Vyacheslav Plakhatnyuk is a political lawyer. He says that such a law would be harmful and could start a process of religious radicalization.
I think that this type of legislative development is harmful because we will orient our society to search for manifestations of anti-religious behavior. On the whole, I think this additional restriction of human rights is absolutely unnecessary.
The legislation criminalizing criticism of religious persons will be discussed in Parliament this fall. The Pussy Riot appeal hearing is set to continue next week. Екатерина Данилова, FSRN, Russia.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news story specials and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is brought to you with support by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Karma Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm provides organic coffee and milks, vegan treats, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at www.firestormcafe.com. Firestorm is currently in the middle of a renovation and should be reopening in, I believe, 2 weeks. They are still hosting events that are scheduled but are not open to the public during the daytime. Otherwise, we're speaking with Gail Stevens, mother of jailed activist and Cleveland 4 defendant Connor Stevens. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about your son? How would you describe him? What drives his idealism?
What drives Connor's idealism, I would say, if I can speak on his behalf, is making a better world for people. He is always for the underdog and always has been since he's been a small child. And he carries a burden in him that I really have not seen the likes of in another person for the underprivileged people of this world, the hungry, the homeless, children, you know, people who are working at minimum wage to try and get by, people that are losing their homes to foreclosure, immigrants. Those are things that he has an exceptionally heavy burden on his heart to change and to help people.
Would you say he is also driven by faith?
I believe he is very much driven by faith. He's a very spiritual person, has gotten very involved in sweat lodges, which is a very spiritual experience for anybody who is familiar with sweat lodges or has studied the information on sweat lodges, following the Good Red Road, the spirit, which is very connected to nature and all things going back to nature, which Connor is very, very much a part. He's driven by nature. And that's always kind of been a struggle for him as far as where he would want to be is out in the woods on a mountaintop by a stream. But where his heart compelled him was to the inner city, that he hated the concrete and the lack of nature, but that's where he felt he was needed. He's also, you know, he also was involved in the Grace Episcopal Church in Cleveland, where he was very close to Father David and was seeking to be baptized, actually, by Father David. He spoke in early April to us, his family, as far as his desire to be a pastor and start a church. So he has a very, very much a spiritual deep side of him that I believe he is driven by faith.
Can you tell listeners about what happened late last year in the Occupy movement in Cleveland?
It was just about a year ago. Connor heard about the Occupy. He was very excited about it, believed that this was something that has not happened in America in a long time, where the 99% could have their voices heard, and believes that, you know, there is power in number and people of being able to create change. So he very much got on board with Occupy, went downtown to Cleveland. I actually visited him on many occasions down there, was actually with him on the day of October 21st, which is a very significant day because that is the day that the informant, Shaquille Azir, came on the scene. And I spent most of that day with Connor. There was a big rally down there, and took him a coat and gloves and hat and some new boots and socks because it was wet and cold and he was freezing. And he was very enthusiastic about being involved in Occupy and creating change for the city of Cleveland. It progressed that they had their permits revoked, that they had to move out of Cleveland.
Was that when they were renting the office space?
Yes, that's then when they went to the office space after they left downtown Cleveland. And they were only at the office space for a short period of time and had to move out of there. And then I believe there was a short period of time. Connor came back home after that and was only here for a few days. And they said that they were reconvening at the warehouse near downtown Cleveland.
The warehouse was a rented space?
They rented from one of the people who was involved in Occupy. It was put in that person's name. And so he quickly, you know, reorganized to go back and join the group, the Occupy group there at the warehouse. And then from there, he would go from the warehouse to downtown to the tents and man the tents. And one of his main responsibilities was the night shift, where he would go down and spend the nights at Occupy in the tents. It was then, during that point, that Occupy was really kind of falling apart and dwindling. And Connor wrote that it was a very dark time in his life, that he had really become like a family with the Occupy people. And they had become a very important network and support, camaraderie in his life. And as Occupy was falling apart, he felt as though he was losing a part of his family and a part of this connection that he was so invested in. And he became depressed and started to go into a very dark place at that point. And that is the same time that he first got involved with Doug and the provocateur, who I like to call the predator, or better yet, the criminal, because that's what he is.
So they initially met on the evening when the permits were revoked for Occupy Cleveland camping, and there was a split between this is like a narrative that I've read, at least. There was a split between the liberal leaders in Occupy who deemed for a certain amount of people who were predetermined, like 11 people, to get arrested in a symbolic act, and the rest of the encampment would split apart. And some of the radicals at that point became angry, and that's sort of when Shaquille Azir, or the Predator, as you call him, sort of like latched on to these angry young men. Is that about right?
That is a myth, as far as that is what the FBI would like to portray as far as what happened that night. As far as accounts by many people that were there that night, there were no angry individuals. There was no behavior that was a red flag that there were a group of, you know, like offshoot angry people that did not like what was going on. And actually, Terry Gilbert, Connor's attorney himself, was there that night. Nobody who was actually there testifies to that being the actual truth of what happened that night. And that is one of the things that Terry, Connor's attorney, was investigating, is why the FBI infiltrated and the cause of them infiltrating, of which they said it was an anonymous call of the angry people and hearing things that might lead to violence. It has never been proven of this anonymous call. So I believe that it was all fabricated by the government themselves.
So how did Shaquille Azir insinuate himself? Did he became friendly with Doug?
Yes, that is who he met on October 21st. He first made contact with Doug. He was only in contact with Doug, I believe, until sometime in February. And that's then where Brandon Baxter became involved. And then after that, Tony and Connor and Joshua Stafford.
Have they been releasing parts of audio tapes? Because this newest article that's on Rolling Stone has a lot of dialogue in it.
There hasn't been any release of audio tapes. There were audio tapes played in court,
mm-hmm.
and the attorneys received the printouts of the audio tapes.
Okay.
But they're sealed. They have not been revealed to the public.
So in the general narrative that is being presented in the media, it sounds like Doug and Brandon are somewhat disaffected members who are people in Occupy and self-identify as anarchists and wanted to like amp up the resistance, but not talking about hurting anyone, but yet like send bigger messages out to the wider culture or wider American landscape and to the government and corporate America.
I think that would be fair to say. Never anything with even, you know, Doug and Brandon at the point of, you know, doing anything that would harm human beings. It was, as you said, just, you know, they were talking about like smoke bombs and paintball guns and stuff like that. Not anything, you know, nowhere near. And that's what, where the whole thing of the informant and the FBI's role comes in, is because they're the ones that amped it up. They're the ones that brought in the suggestion of, because obviously they were going after specific charges and they wanted to create certain specific charges with this. And it wouldn't have been much of a case if they got these guys on paintball guns and smoke bombs. Over and over again in the transcripts, it's repeated by Shaquille Azeer as amping it up and making a plan, and they had to come up with a plan. And every time they would re-meet, he would say, you know, we need to move forward on this, and you guys aren't, you know, deciding anything. It was at his constant going back to them and pushing and then suggesting to them the C4.
And getting them in contact with an individual who allegedly could get a hold of the stuff. And
correct. And which is a very important point also, that even when he first told Doug Wright that he could get the C4, Doug Wright told him no. And then he went back again and is pushing it again. And, you know, they don't have money. So that's a whole, you know, to me right there is like, okay, these guys, they couldn't have hardly afforded the gas because they didn't have money, let alone something like C4.
The tear gas canisters, you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
They literally provided everything.
Let's talk a minute about Shaquille Azeer and a little bit about that person's history as far as we're aware. I think a story came out on Smoking Gun a few months back, and it talked about Shaquille's history of cocaine possession and fraudulent checks and things like that. People commit crimes or at least get prosecuted for crimes, and that's just a reality of situations. So that's nothing against anyone for those sort of things, but it seems fitting when looking at the history of how the FBI dealt with movements like the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement in the 60s and 70s through the counterintelligence program. They employed a lot of snitches and agent provocateurs who had criminal histories who could sort of like purge bits of their criminal history through service to the government. You know, so they hire someone who's got this history of lying, basically, or as I think the government defines the crime. Let's see if I can find it. It was like a crime of dishonesty, I think, was passing fraudulent checks and things like that. And they had him insinuate himself into and create a group or group, get together a grouping of people who were maybe disaffected with the direction that they saw Occupy going. And he's supposed to be trusted as a government informant, even while he continued passing fraudulent checks while being employed by the federal government.
That should make people outraged. Within days of being hired as an informant, he passed another $6,000 fraudulent check. And that's one of my points as well, is that it doesn't make any sense to me why we as the American people would be okay with our government using informants that are criminals. I don't understand how an informant's word on the stand could be credible. If I was put on the stand and they bring up my background and I have a criminal background and I have lied and I have cheated and I have stolen, and that automatically makes me a non-credible witness. And the jury looks at that person and says, well, how can we believe anything that they're saying? But the government uses those exact people with a very strong motive of getting their charges dropped, not doing prison time, lowering any financial penalties, and so forth. How does the FBI even know that they're being honest with them? You know, and how is the FBI employing somebody who is still passing fraudulent checks?
So let's talk about the role of people like Shaquille Azir and what direction the government is going with something like this. You were mentioning at one point earlier when you were going to pick up Connor from the warehouse, and he mentioned that you're probably being followed by the FBI at this point, and the sense of kind of like unreality of that statement, that like maybe it was a joke or whatever, because it, you know, to the normal American mind, to the mainstream American mind, it doesn't seem like a reasonable thing. Why would I'm going to pick up my son from a warehouse where he's been hanging out and sleeping? Why would I possibly be under surveillance from the FBI? Let's talk for a minute about this sort of predation that the U.S. government's been participating in these sort of entrapment cases, going after certain personalities or people who seem like they're kind of on the outskirts or in need of food and shelter and community, and then providing those things in order to build a case and talk people into things they probably wouldn't have done by themselves otherwise. By going in there with a preconceived notion, the federal government tried to build trust and build a connection between itself and idealistic individuals under a false pretense of, you know, and a false identity of other activists, of being other activists within this movement wanting to bring about social change. And building those connections and those trusts under that false pretense in order to get the person caught, in order to catch them in this web, is in some ways comparable to what, say, like sexual predators do.
Exactly. And I think that it's so important for people to realize how closely it is similar. And they use the exact same tactics as a sexual predator does. And people have no tolerance for sexual predators and their behavior. But if I compare them to the FBI and their tactics, and that the tactics that they use are the exact same tactics that a sexual predator uses, we should be just as mortified, just as vocal about them doing that behavior and using those tactics on American citizens, just as much as we are outraged when it happens with a sexual predator. The Shaquille, yes, met them, befriended them, gained their trust.
Employed them.
So all the money that they received in order to even buy the C4 was actually money from Shaquille. He was paying them under the table, which I believe that's illegal in the United States to pay people under the table. But he was doing it. He was paying them, so he gave them a job. And for Connor, this was his first job. This is the first job Connor ever had. And
Connor's 20, right?
Yes, yeah. He's 20. And he, as hard as the work was, like he would text me and say, you know, work 12 hours today. He was paying them like $5 an hour. You know, work 12 hours today, you know, dead tired, have to get up early tomorrow if I want to do it again. He would come back to the warehouse just like covered in insulation and his skin would be burning and itching. But he liked the work. He liked what he was learning as far as it was like construction. And I know that that's one of the things that, you know, Connor talked about is like refurbishing old houses or abandoned places and being able to refurbish them so that people could actually live there. So I know and believe that he was learning a skill that he thought would also be helpful in his future. On top of that, he was buying them cigarettes. There was an endless supply of beer. They would show up to work in the morning and there would be a case of beer for them to start their day. He would give them marijuana. He gave them Adderall, which I believe is also a felony. And Connor and Joshua Stafford, I believe, and Brandon Baxter are underage. Marijuana, which, again, is a legal, illegal substance that I would get arrested for, but they can pass that on to them and supply that to them. The Adderall just completely, I think, is an issue that people really need to understand, like the effects of Adderall. And when you take Adderall and you don't need it, what it does to you mentally, how it revs you up, how you can talk and talk and talk and talk and don't even know what you're talking about, how it puts you in a mind state where you are very much more conducive to go along with things that are being suggested and planned and talked about, which I think is a very important part of this case. And I also think it's very interesting that they supplied them with that specific drug because of the side effects of it. I believe 100% that played a part in these guys being compliant.
Working off the assumption that, like, these people, the four defendants, or the five at the time before one of them, before Tony took a plea deal, a cooperating plea, why was the federal government paying Shaquille Azeer $6,000 or $6,500 to infiltrate Occupy? Why do you feel, what's your opinion on why they wanted to spend that money and infiltrate this nonviolent movement that was calling for economic and social justice in the U.S. What needs does it serve for the federal government?
So I believe that from the very beginning, there was an agenda on the FBI's part, and they led the informant through on that agenda every step of the way.
Would you say that the original date for the trial being September 17th followed in with this plan?
Yes. There are times where through this I have thought, geez, Gail, are you getting paranoid yourself? There's just too many things that I have seen happen since Connor's arrest, but so many things that I have found out firsthand about this that there's just too many things that add up as far as how manipulated it all is. And yes, I believe that the case was moved from Cleveland to Akron as a direct manipulated plan. Because in Cleveland, on the first day of their hearing, there were so many supporters, so many friends and family for these guys, that they had to move courtrooms because the courtroom that they had it assigned to wasn't big enough to hold everybody. And I think right from the beginning, when they saw the incredible amount of support that these guys were getting in Cleveland, that it was moved to Akron. Because logistically, now we're an hour away and it's a lot harder for people to get to Akron. Although we still have gone to every Akron hearing, the support group has gone to every Akron hearing, but not nearly as many people can get to Akron as can get to Cleveland. I think the trial date was something that was specifically manipulated. The day of their arrest was specifically manipulated because of May Day. The informant was at that point, I believe, he was really pushing it hard. And you could tell that through the transcripts of, at that point, really amping it up himself, that this had to happen by a certain day. And I think the whole planning of it at the time of May Day and then being arrested on April 30th was completely manipulated by the government.
We'll be right back with our conversation with Gail Stevens, mother of Connor Stevens, one of the Cleveland Four defendants, right after this break.
They say I'm crying before quickly burn, like rain candles trying to kiss the skyline. Smoke some opium, my close friend whispered smiling. And I realized that Venus was her name. This pregnant goddess orbiting the sun, her breasts poured forth the stars and constellations. We rose above the subways and bus stations, alive broken matches we tangled. La 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 la. I find myself once more beside a dark and human sign of weary sorrow. So drinking coffee and waiting for tomorrow. I'm full of hope, but sure no cigarette. Still full of hope, but out of sin.
Let's return to our conversation with Gail Stevens, mother of Connor Stevens, one of the defendants in the Cleveland Four case. So let's talk about where they're at legally right now, where the four defendants are. Like I said, Tony took a cooperating plea deal, I think about a month ago, and three of the other defendants are currently have taken non-cooperating pleas. Those being Connor, Doug, and Brandon, correct?
That is correct.
Pleading guilty to all charges.
Except the terrorism enhancement.
Except the terrorism enhancement. Okay. So what are the charges that they're facing?
Both conspiracy and attempt to use a weapon of mass destruction as two different charges, the terrorism enhancement charges.
Can you hear that? That's my son, Colin, talking.
Yeah.
And so two conspiracy and attempts to use weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, those are two separate charges.
And then there's an enhancement on top of those for terrorism?
Yes. There's also a third charge, though, attempted to damage like commerce.
Can you tell listeners about where Joshua is at right now, if he's not one of the folks that has taken the non-cooperating guilty plea minus terrorist enhancements?
What happened with Joshua is his lawyers put in a motion for him to have a psychiatric evaluation done, and the judge granted that motion. So at that point, the judge also stated that his trial date would be at a future undetermined time. So he is still at Northeast Ohio Correctional Center in Youngstown, awaiting to be transferred to an out-of-state facility for psychiatric evaluation.
And he had at one point, according to what I've read in some of the articles, stated that he had schizophrenia. Is that right?
I believe that is documented, yes.
So the deal that the three have taken so far – is non-cooperating. Can you tell listeners what exactly that means, as opposed to what Tony took?
Definitely, because it's important for people to realize that there is a very big difference between what Tony did and what Connor, Doug, and Brandon did. The plea that Tony took was in direct cooperation as far as working with the FBI, as far as in agreeing to testify at trial on the stand as a witness of the FBI, versus the plea that Connor, Doug, and Brandon took as non-cooperative. It was not at all to do with the government or FBI. It was between them and the judge, so to speak, that they were pleading guilty in completely really cutting out anything with the government. That's a very important point to make, and I heard an attorney say that there's no such thing as a non-cooperative plea, and that I don't want people to believe that in any way, shape, or form. Terry Gilbert, who is Connor's attorney, states full well that, yes, there's definitely such a thing as a non-cooperative
plea. And so despite pleading guilty, they still have legal fees that need to be covered, right? And that's like one of the important things is a lot of people don't want to give support to people who are cooperating with the government in cases like this. But since these people are standing together, what can you tell about the funding needs of the Cleveland Four?
Anybody knows that legal fees do not come by cheaply. And to have these guys represented in light of this case and what a big case this is takes a lot of legal work, which is expensive. And, you know, that's another whole thing that, there's so many different places we could go as far as in the FBI's manipulating and planning and how they pick who they pick for such cases. It is not going to be people who can afford a good attorney. It is always going to be people who don't have any money and are going to have to fall on the system to provide them attorneys, which makes a big difference in cases like this. To get an attorney who has done FBI entrapment cases, terrorism cases, has done civil rights cases, who is very informed as far as activists and so forth, that takes money to get somebody to know how to really work a case and do a case justice like this. So, yes, it is troublesome that people would think that because they took a plea that they don't want to support them legally anymore or with the legal fund. And I hope that people have that erased. When Tony took, yes, we washed our hands of Tony and do not support him at all at this point. The Cleveland Support Group meets every single Sunday at the Catholic storefront in Cleveland. Even though it's not obviously gone to trial, there is a lot of work and preparation going on for their sentencing hearing that is going to make a significant difference in these guys' futures.
Can you talk a little bit about what the strategy was that determined that they would take a plea?
Strategy for them taking a plea came from the sad truth of history since 9/11 and what 9/11 brought about in this country was such cases as this being created by the FBI not being able to be fought and won in our legal justice system, which kind of is tongue-in-cheek, because if it's a justice system, how could you possibly not be able to go and fight and win a true entrapment case? But since 9/11, an entrapment case has not been won. So it changed a lot of things in federal courts. If people look at the history of what has happened in federal cases, and specifically cases like this since 9/11, there has been a lot of changes made within the federal system. And to go and move forward with a jury is extremely, extremely risky. They are going to out the FBI as they, you know, believe is just to do. Why they do believe it was a matter of entrapment. They're going to be able to do that through their sentencing hearing, because they all deserve to have a future and to be able to be in society, making a difference in society and contributing their talents and gifts to society.
So one of the narratives that has kind of come up around the case has been to sort of excuse the fact that, like, there was this, if you believe the government's narrative that these people were wrangled together and were going to blow up a bridge, the idea is that, oh, that was a stupid idea anyway, so who cares? Or the idea that these were a bunch of dumb stoner kids. As a mother of one of the defendants, how do you take to those sort of arguments? Being young and being idealistic and being talked into something, like, how do you walk that line of promoting the fact that these were intelligent, sensitive, caring individuals, and also that they were pressured into this?
Well, I think a really important point to make is that it's not that they didn't have the intelligence or the capability to do it. It's not who they are as human beings to do it. It would not have been their motive or their path to take. It is extremely insultive to, and I know that Connor does not like being portrayed that way at all. He is not a dumb stoner kid who doesn't even know how to blow his own nose. Connor is extremely intelligent. He's extremely gifted, as I'm sure the other guys are as well. I obviously don't know them as I know my own son. But to say that they couldn't even blow their own noses is extremely patronizing and insulting. They aren't a bunch of unintelligent, stupid stoner people. What people need to realize is that, and you don't have to be an unintelligent stoner, homeless person to have something like this happen to you, that people can be overcome by influence, manipulation, brainwashed, if you want to say, certainly mind control involved. And that can happen to any intelligent person, I believe, given the right circumstances. And if people think that, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, that could never happen to me, and I would have just said no, and, you know, if somebody would have brought that idea up to me, it would have been, you know, I'm out of here. That just is making it so simple out of something that is much more complicated and takes time over a whole lot more time than just a simple conversation. You know, if the informant would have walked up to Doug on October 21st, and said, hey, I have some C4, let's go blow up, or I can get you some C4, let's go blow up a bridge, Doug would have said, no, you're out of your mind. Informant walks away, and that would have been the end of it. That's not how it happened.
Is there actually a trial date coming up because they've given these, or it's just a sentencing hearing? And when is that?
Yeah. It's a sentencing hearing that is going to happen November 5th and 6th.
And in the meantime, I know there's the Cleveland 4 Solidarity website for the number 4, and that's probably going to keep updated with the contact information for each of the defendants. What kind of support and what are like, are people receiving mail right now? Do people need books? Do people need, like, what kind of, outside of the monetary Indiegogo and like legal fundraising, what kind of support do the defendants need?
They definitely need letters of support. That is something that I think anybody could do that is very easy, that when these guys receive a letter of support, it makes their day, it makes their week, it makes their month. So that is something that is very important, to support them through letter writing. Unless you have been in prison, and these guys, Connor and Brandon, both spent 3 months in solitary confinement before they were moved, were taken to a protective pod. I don't think anybody knows, unless you've been locked behind concrete and barbed wire fences, how you feel cut off and alone, and the world is going on without you. And one of the things that is very important to me is, and I promised to Connor, that what happened will not be in vain. As far as books or information, something that they really all request is being kept up on what is going on in, you know, the country, news, what's going on in activist groups. So even printing off an article and mailing it to them is something huge that people can do. We also do, if people, and there are constant updates on the website, so I do encourage people to continually check in on the website, which again is Cleveland 4 Solidarity, the number 4, solidarity.org. And one of the things that we are doing now is a letter writing campaign for them, which we have a post on there giving an outline of how to address the letters, where the letters should go in support of the guys. If people knew them individually, as far as activists themselves, people who may have been in similar situations that can relate to this, people who are outraged that this is happening in the United States of America, please, you can write a letter to Judge Dowd in behalf of this case and these guys, and that can be used for help in their sentencing hearing. But please read the guidelines on the website for that, because those came from an attorney, so the guidelines are well written.
And
there's things in there such as, you know, don't go off on the FBI or the government, or don't, you know, try and justify their actions. So people have to be careful in writing that they're not, like, going off on a tangent.
And then there's also the instructions from this month about how to write a letter to the editor, to your local newspaper, sort of, like, shift the narrative, too.
Yes, and that's something that can be very helpful, too. The more that they hear as far as letters to the editor in both the Cleveland Magazine, any of the local newspapers, the Rolling Stones article, people's voices need to be heard, and this is a way that people can let their voices be heard to move forward for change.
And one could also buy one of the nifty T-shirts that are available through the Indiegogo campaign on the Cleveland 4 website.
Yes, which they are, when you see them in person, they are beautiful T-shirts.
So as someone who's been very close to the case, I'd be interested in hearing what your response to the recent article of, I think, September 17th by Sabrina Rubin Erdely from Rolling Stone. What your responses are to that article. The title of the article was "The Plot Against Occupy: How the Government Turned Five Stoner Misfits into the World's Most Hapless Terrorist Cell."
Well, first I'll start out with a couple of positives. I was glad to see, like, a quote from a former FBI agent, that states the government has a responsibility to prevent harm, but instead they're manufacturing threatening events. So it does bring to light some of what is going on with our federal government and the use of informants. But I was very disappointed in the article as far as what the agenda of the article actually was and what people walk away from the article. I believe that there are inaccuracies, untruths in the article. Just for an example, where it is stated that how they, you know, left the site of planting the bombs, and they were feeling pretty good. Where did Sabrina get that they were feeling pretty good? She did not interview any of these guys. That is not in quotation marks. That is something that she put into the article. I know she wasn't there that night with them, so I'm not sure where they were feeling pretty good comes from. She does make a quote of something that Connor said that has been published and been used as far as where he stated, we just committed the biggest act of terrorism, and says that that was saying, was being said as they were jogging away from the site. And that is completely untrue. When that statement that he said has been quoted, it has never been put into context of the conversation that was going on. They were actually in the car when Connor said that, and it was in the midst of a whole conversation that if the whole conversation was heard, you come away with a very different perception of that statement. They're just things as though she is putting herself in their mind and stating stuff from all of the guys as though she knows them or she talked to them, and she didn't. As a matter of fact, she wrote Connor and gave him a list of questions that Connor did not respond to and refused to respond to because he said he did not like her line of questioning. And none of the guys responded. They talk about Brandon being part of a Nazi group. This person who is very close to Brandon and knows Brandon very well says that that is, you know, an out-and-out lie, that he was never part of a Nazi group.
Yeah, it really does read like the end of a novel, something that ties something together, or pop psychology.
And, I mean, the whole line that says, perhaps in the end, after all their efforts, the feds really did get the terrorists they wanted. Really? I mean, that is just despicable. And what is really infuriating is she wants to put this article out there exposing, supposedly, the tactics of the FBI and how wrong this is, and that how these guys were preyed upon. But yet when the reader walks away, I believe, from this article, they are more likely to walk away with thinking, well, you know what, whatever the tactics the government had to use, so be it, because they did get the bad guys. She is talking about Agape House.
Mm-hmm.
She goes on to talk about the it as
a squat.
Yeah, a squat and a what do they call it? Condemned building.
Uh-huh.
With, you know, spray paint all over it. That's the warehouse. That's not the Agape House, and she's referring to it as the Agape House.
What is the Agape House?
The Agape House is a house that Connor moved to last spring, and it is a house of that a group of guys moved into and called themselves Christian anarchists. They had goals of going out into the community and helping the community, working with neighbors, planting gardens, having Bible studies, helping the inner Cleveland area. And one of the important things as far as with the Agape House too, like they were doing the same thing as like Food Not Bombs, as far as on Sundays they would cook a big meal and open the front doors, and anybody who wanted to come in and needed to eat could come into their house and eat. That's the type of activity that was going on at the Agape House that Connor was very interested in and very involved with. As a matter of fact, Connor was the main gardener of the house. Gardening is one of Connor's loves.
In your view, Gail, did the author of the article, The Plot Against Occupy, Sabrina Rubin Erdely, act irresponsibly by building Connor into a character, by haphazardly throwing together what she'd heard about Connor's sexuality, family legal history, and class background?
Yes, I would definitely say that she threw that together haphazardly. And I don't know her motive or reasoning for doing so. Also, those points have absolutely nothing to do with facts of the case or what is actually going on in this case. So to put things in like that and to be irresponsible as a journalist in doing so is very upsetting and really, degrades her, I think, as a journalist, which is too bad, you know, that a journalist would put themselves in that position.
Besides Connor's sexuality having nothing to do with the case at all, what does that sort of dialogue, like what danger does that put Connor in as someone who is in a prison currently?
That puts his safety. That puts his physical safety at risk. So to put somebody in position and to not have the person okay or approval or is completely irresponsible.
Also, with the way that the neighborhood that you you at least had, where Connor had been living with you, was described in there as a bourgeois suburb of Cleveland. Can you talk a little bit about Berea?
Yeah, that's that actually is something that really made me chuckle. Again, her own embellishments, her own. She's never been to my house. She never met me. I never talked to her. And to say that Connor was from the bourgeois suburbs, we live in Berea. If anybody's familiar, with the Cleveland area, Berea is not a bourgeois. It's a very middle-class suburb. I live in a 1,100-square-foot bungalow house. 8 people live here with me, my family. Couldn't be farther from the truth. So somebody's going to read the article, and it puts a perception in their mind, whether it's of his sexuality, whether it's of history of his father, the suburb that he came from, is all creating a perception in people's minds that don't know the actual people involved or the circumstances involved, and they have nothing to go on except what this person is writing. Right, I received this letter today. It's for Nevaeh, which is Connor's 5-year-old niece, and he states, "Dear Nevaeh, above all else, I'll be looking forward to your hug, your kiss, and maybe even a tickle when I get out. Sometimes I'm scared to be here because I think of what I'm missing, what I threw away, what I will miss out on, what all may happen while I'm in here, and I get scared. You are the first to ask me that. It's true, I may be out soon. You never know. I love you too, Nevaeh, really much. It's going to be fall soon, and we'll have all the beautiful benefits that come with it, the crisp air, the colors, the smells, the change in feeling, a great time when everyone returns home. It may take me a few autumns to make it home, though." Sorry. He says, "What do you do outside these days? getting cooler, darker. How's the garden, yard? I love you with every fiber of my being. All my love. We'll be hugging one another sooner rather than later. Take care of yourself, your mom, the family. Never stop listening to who you are, to your heart. Always dance, always laugh, always smile like you do. And before you know it, I'll be there dancing, laughing, and smiling with you too. Always with you when I close my eyes, Uncle Connor.
Do they get to actually hug when they visit?
No, they're non-contact visits. So we see them behind a glass wall.
Well, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just, to me, it just shows what a sweetheart he is, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, Connor's very lucky to have a family that's so supportive. It's been great talking to you. I really hope that the case goes well and that folks end up communicating with Connor and the other defendants and showing them support.
Yes, I certainly do too. And thank you so much for taking your time.
We've been speaking with Gail Stevens, mother of Connor Stevens. Connor is one of the young anarchists accused of attempting to blow up a bridge outside of Cleveland, Ohio on May Day of this year. To learn more about this case and see how you can support the defendants as they attempt to prove that they were entrapped by the FBI, check out the website clevelandforsolidarity.org. That's the number 4, clevelandforsolidarity.org. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bruce Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is brought to you with support by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Karma Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm provides organic coffee and milks, vegan treats, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at www.firestormcafe.com. Firestorm is currently in the middle of a renovation and should be reopening in, I believe, 2 weeks. They are still hosting events that are scheduled but are not open to the public during the daytime. Otherwise,